but somebody misunderstood Francis Bacon to think it meant France space is
is
space bacon.
Yeah, it's not a good look when the host can't figure out how the fuck their audio works. Unplugging things, replugging. Oh, God.
Maren, did I tell you that, like, after... So we caught up, like, 2.5 weeks ago, and that's kind of the genesis of this conversation. But as I was leaving, I, like, was just trying to have a quick pee in the ocean and then go on my way. And I just, like, ate shit face forward into the water, and all these people around were... Everyone started laughing at me.
I had no idea that you were that far gone. Like, I assumed that you were as, like, lightly tipsy as I was up until the moment that you went face first into the water.
Had you taken your instrument out of your pants when you fell? Or, like, what was the
state of... I think you had already peed. I think you fell into your pee, more or less.
It was, like, wow. I think it was a wow peeing kind of thing. So it like, I kind of caught some of the stream, like, as I fell into it. I don't even remember what happened to the zipper, but presumably all my parts are in their proper place. But so that was the origin of this conversation. And so, like, it was kind of cool because it was the first time my dear friend Marianne and I had caught up, and we were both...
It had been a couple of years, actually, of in person. Like, I think we spoke on the phone a summer or two ago, but it had been a couple of years. I was living in the Caribbean for a couple of years there, and I'm now back. And Vaden thought that I was bobbing around in the ocean all of last year, but I wasn't. I was in an apartment in Vancouver, laying low like everyone else.
Do you want to go into some of the shipwreck stories, or is that too much? That may be too much for right now.
But... I mean, let's just say that somebody bought a very expensive boat 17 days before a very severe hurricane, and it was destroyed. The insurance company didn't come through.
Shit.
It turned into a whole scandal. There's a big legal battle going on right now. And so we were down there doing the work that the insurance company was supposed to cover. Thankfully, not myself personally, but I guess we collectively are trying to recover some of those funds.
Because you had thought that you and your partner would arrive at the Caribbean to, like, a fully functioning boat.
Yeah, we've fully prepared to just start chartering. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to start at, like, a charter business.
God.
And instead we sat in, like, a boatyard where there was no wind, not even the slightest breeze, for 9 months in the heat while all of our friends thought that we were living in, like, a tropical paradise. I mean, it was like one of us cried at least once every single day for that 9 months. Somebody shed a tear.
but let's not forget how the story ends on an optimistic note, because you finally come back to Vancouver and you're excited to just, like, put all this behind you, and then COVID begins.
Yes.
If I got the chronology right.
In fact, I had come back for a doctor's appointment and had packed, like, a week's worth of belongings, and then everything shut down 3 days after I got here. So I mean, it was an incredible experience. The way that I describe it to people is that the highs were very high, and we had some very incredible, like, mind blowing experiences, and the lows were, like, just so low.
Were you originally going to move there, like
no,
forever?
Not permanently.
Like,
it was a multi-year plan. This fall, my partner is going to head back down there for a few months here and there and do some chartering. But it was meant to be, like, a couple year a hiatus before I went back to school. And yeah, it turned into quite the adventure. So, yeah.
But we're glad you're alive. But so back to the context. So, like, we were talking about that. And then I was kind of talking about how I had just a fucking crazy COVID breakdown that we talked about in the podcast before, and I guess you had, like, would it be too much to say, like, a period of radicalization and de-radicalization?
Oh yeah.
Is that too strong?
I don't know
what's the appropriate language, because, like, I guess COVID has been psychologically challenging for all of us, and we just had very interesting different experiences, and that's kind of the genesis of this conversation.
Yeah, so, and like you know, for context in that too, Vaden was sort of watching my life. The glimpse that you had into my life was purely what I was posting on Instagram. Like that was really it. Mm-hmm. That was the only, we didn't really have any conversation throughout that time. And so I suppose that would be the case for a lot of people in my life. And the word radicalization, I think maybe a few months ago, as I was still sort of trying to process this and break it down and sort of separate my ego from it all, that term might have seemed a bit too, I would have been very like, oh, I don't want to say that that's what happened. But, you know, in some ways, yeah. I mean, in some ways, yeah, I would absolutely say that's accurate. There were a lot of aspects of like what I was sort of putting out there of like my brain really mismatching my emotions. So I would think, well, I don't really agree with that. But then I was sort of, because I was sort of buying into a larger narrative, it's like, yeah, well, but I kind of have, you know, I sort of felt like my hands were tied in a lot of ways. So there were a lot of aspects that I didn't sort of go on to promote myself because they didn't sit right with me, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it because I had already sort of fed into this other set of like alternative logic that made that very difficult to distinguish.
I guess we should zoom out, contextualize, because
Ben has no idea what.
So let's just go from the beginning and like let's totally set the stage.
Yeah,
and let's get into the details because I'm so fucking fascinated by this whole thing.
Yeah, well me too. And I think the timing of this is great. I'll say like just to off the bat, I think the timing is great. If we had sat down a month or 2 months ago, I think it would have been too soon. Granted, it's been quite a while since I've radicalized.
No, sorry. Let's not use that word.
I was going to say detransition, but that's not the right word either. So.
That's going to land us in even hotter water.
So, I mean, I guess, you know, it began for me where it began for almost everyone, which was when George Floyd died. And if you had asked me in that moment, I would have said Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd with racialized intention. And I was very quickly swept up into, like, I mean, I would say it almost happened overnight. Like hard as that might be, I think for Vaden to maybe believe, knowing the version of myself that you knew from a couple of years ago, it really happened almost overnight. And I was so full of anger. I mean, the anger was like red hot. And part of this was because I was, you know, I mean, I was trapped in an apartment and I was working in, before I went to the Caribbean, I was working in events, which no longer existed when I came back. So, you know, I wasn't working. I was home alone for most of the day. And I was seeing what was going on, and I was seeing it through a variety of sources, mostly through social media. A lot of my family is from Tennessee in the States. And, I was seeing a lot of, sort of disturbing things that kind of disturbed and alarmed me. What was the slogan? Shooting the looting or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of phrases being thrown out. I have a couple of cousins who are, quite conservative.
So this is pushback to the protests that erupted.
Yes, yes.
With respect to George Floyd. Yes. Okay, yeah.
And so I was seeing this sort of happening, and I was sort of homesick for the States for the first time. Like I really felt in my heart that I almost felt a guilt. I almost felt a guilt that I wasn't there. And I don't know why. I don't know what it was that I thought I would have done there, or why I felt so compelled towards this one issue. And I was also having conversations with my immediate family. My dad has views that I think can come off quite
Republican.
Yes.
That's too strong.
Well,
sorry, that's too strong. Republican is now too strong. How dare you? Yeah.
just get it. Just
well, let's just say he can speak about things in sort of a robotic way at times, and it can be easy to sort of misinterpret the tone of what he's saying for the words that he's saying. And so we were, I was, the point being, we were also sort of having conversations that were leading to a lot of really upsetting roadblocks, all surrounding this issue of race and police brutality. And so from there, I would say, you know, what really kicked it off was I was angry. I was sad. I was somewhat isolated. And, my partner, I was seeing my partner, but she was working. And to be honest, she just loves boats and doesn't really bother herself with a lot of these things. You know, it wasn't like weighing on her in the same way.
Blissfully apolitical.
Yeah. Which is a lovely way to exist, to be honest.
100%.
Yeah.
And really what really kicked it off was when I created my own echo chamber through social media. And that happened very quickly. And it was very easy to do, especially on TikTok. I don't know if you guys are familiar with TikTok or if you have ever use the app. The way that the algorithm works, not that I know all of the details, but it's almost designed to let you know that it's there.
Ooh, like fascinating.
You really curate your own experience. So when you scroll through a daily feed, you're scrolling up and you can hit a like button. If you hit a like button, you're going to get more content that has, you know, the way that you would imagine any social media app to work. You can also click a button that says, do not show me any more of this content.
Oh, wow.
So it's very easy to start filtering things out. Now, what will happen is if you say that you don't like a piece of content, it won't show you that for quite a while. But every so often, it'll show you one. And I believe this is to sort of check in and say, like, are you still interested, maybe? And it becomes very clear that you can... Even the amount of time that you view a video has an effect. It's very easy to quickly hone down your algorithm by continually liking the same content. And within a day, your entire feed is curated to the mood of the week. So it's a really cool tool in that way. And I actually think that TikTok is a far superior app in terms of learning and networking than many other social media apps, but it has that sort of like just so easy to create your own echo chamber.
Because I imagine at the time you know you're curating content, but it's research. You're trying to learn more about the issue. Yes.
So that's a great way to put it. That's a great way to put it. In my own mind, as you would say, like researching this topic, and I was really like I was seeing so many videos and so much footage of cops just beating the shit out of people. And I was seeing these all day throughout the day. Just, I mean, like I could,
oh my God.
There were days where hours would go by and I was like, you know, just so Jesus. Inundated with this. And it was almost like an addicting, it very clearly had like a negative addicting quality.
It strikes me as really interesting because with TikTok, it's very easy to curate the content you see, but not with social media that has family members. So it's not easy to curate Facebook. So you have one social media, which is kind of giving you a curated amount of content from non-progressive people in your life from the South. And then you're creating kind of opposite content for yourself. Mm-hmm. And now there's this like war of content that you're seeing simultaneously.
Yeah, and then so I then take all of that and go to Instagram.
Yeah. Yes, and then
launch my own. Yeah.
Great, yeah. Not to interrupt you.
So I can't really remember when I started posting on it. I don't think it was very long after, but I think the first post that I made, I think I made a statement that was maybe not in defense. Well, it was fully in defense of the looting and the property damage that was occurring afterwards. And it was from a very sympathetic place of like, maybe we need to give this community a minute to, and of course this is all founded on the idea that George Floyd's killing was due to his race. Which I know there's a long history in the States, especially with all of the people that Black Lives Matter specifically, are pointing out. And I'm going to jump a little out of turn here, but like where I'm sitting now, what I find really interesting about it is I can watch those same videos and see them in a completely different light. Like completely differently, in the right down to the sense where I'm feeling scared for the police officer in some of these situations, which to me, like as interesting as it is that I sort of went down this path, it's almost more interesting the way that I've come out of it on the other side. Almost feeling like a political orphan. Like, I don't know where I stand anymore. I've had to now question literally everything. Like I'm not denying climate change, but I've had to admit like, yeah, but you have no idea. Yeah. Like the science behind, like you actually need to go and investigate these things. And sort of realizing that most people, that I'm around have some version of a narrative that they have accepted that may be true and we may accept as true, but they don't know why it's true. I mean, I don't need to thoroughly investigate the critics of gravity at this point. You know, I can just accept something, you know? And I can assume that's not going to change anytime soon either. I don't need to go back and review that concept. But it really does. I mean, I really did feel like my world was shaken up almost more by stepping out of this than by stepping in, and in a positive way, in a very positive way. But it's my life has become increasingly more exhausting because I'm now questioning everything, and I'm slowly. Moving out of that and becoming a little more normalized, but reflecting back on it, there's you know, this little piece of paranoia of like, well, can I trust my own brain? Like, can I trust my own judgment?
So in your case, like, you're just zooming out from the specific politics, Marianne. So, you know, you're at this point, you see very you know, disturbing content, and I think all of us were like watching these kind of videos and like obviously very disturbed at what you're seeing, and then so you, this pushes you in a certain political direction, and then you surround yourself with like more voices who are pointing out like similar injustices and things like this. And so I'm curious, just at like a meta level, how did you go from, it sounds like these kind of ideas got very intertwined with like your identity, and you're sort of brooding on this all day, and like, this is all you're thinking about. And so I'm curious, like, how did you start taking on like different perspectives, or like what opened the door to just like seeing things differently, whether, you know, that was right or wrong, but just like what was sort of the crack in the armor there?
You know, as I really try to make sense of this, it really came down for me personally, and I do think that this is something that is maybe a root cause for at least some number of people. I'm not saying it's universal, but for myself, I was not in a good place. On the surface, I was, and if you had asked me back then, I would have said that I was. In retrospect, I was not mentally or emotionally at my best by any stretch. And I think there was a small amount of unwillingness to fully face the things that were causing me that unease in my life. And by refusing to sort of look at my own issues, I think it became much easier to just look out at the world's issues. So I think that was a bit of a catalyst there. It's like, if that condition hadn't been there, I don't think that I would have really wandered down that path. I think in terms of accepting some of the actual viewpoints that were coming from, I don't know what we want to refer to this group of.
There's not a good label for it, but we can say woke, we can say politically correct, we can say.
Yeah, that, like the social justice side of things. Something I've been thinking about a lot is like, I'm a very I'm a very tend towards anger kind of person. I think most people, when they're experiencing something negative, they tend to sort of tend towards maybe more, they're more at ease with sadness, or they're more at ease with anger. And, you know, I think sadness is just such a passive emotion. It's very heavy. It's an inactive emotion to some degree, whereas anger is like full steam ahead. It's active. It's take control. You are compelled to do something about it. And I've always been a tend towards anger person. And, you know, there's a reason why it's like blinding anger. I think that your brain capacity, when you're that fired up and that angry, is really, I mean, I think it's diminished because you're sort of overtaken by the emotion. And then I think that, for myself personally, there's, when you're looking at any sort of any problem, any complex problem, and you have a bit of a diminished sort of capacity to handle that, the overwhelming nature of it, it just forces you to try to simplify it. It's like, okay, well, I'm just going to simplify it. And once you simplify it, you're no longer actually dealing with a true version of the problem to begin with. But it becomes very easy. I mean, it just becomes very easy to, from that point of anger, from that point of overwhelm, to then simplify the problem, therefore simplify the solution. All of a sudden you have an enemy, a clearly defined enemy that isn't yourself. And so if you're having problems with yourself and you don't really want to look at those problems or deal with those problems, you're still going to be upset about something, and that energy needs to be directed somewhere. So if you're not willing to look towards yourself, that energy just gets directed out there. And I don't mean energy in a woo-woo way. I just mean that mentality. And so for me personally, that was like the undoing aspect of it. Like, you know, that's how I would describe the root of how I got into it, but, started wandering down that path, and the opposite sort of happened as I came out of it, which was, in October of last year. A lot of my friends were doing a sober October, and I decided to do a social media sober October, and then carried that through November, and then carried that through December, and was like, oh, wow, I am
nice.
Feeling much better, you know, and dealing with sort of some of my own issues. But I had to completely disconnect from it. And even after 1 month away from it, I was afraid to go back to it. So I just...
See, Baden, social media sucks, man. Case closed. We've got to reopen that argument. And yeah.
Well, so let's not open the social media thing just yet. We can maybe do that later. But there's just such a rich territory. I don't want to drown out the conversation in that. But maybe I'll say a little bit about from my perspective, because like you said, there's three social media forces at play at this time in your life. There's like the Southern right leaning force, and then there's the TikTok left leaning force. And then there's the Instagram neutral Vancouver, what the hell is happening to our dear friend, Marianne, onlooker force.
To be clear, I had created a little echo chamber on Instagram as well. But I was spending more time on TikTok.
Yeah.
And I was, Ben, a lot of what I was reposting, so to give you some context on this, I was reposting videos specifically of police brutality, which there's a whole argument within the like social justice community over whether or not it's okay to do that, because it could be triggering for people. And then there's the other side of it, which is, no, we have to face the injustices of the world. And so one thing that I haven't really fully worked out, so I'd be interested in your input on this, is how it is that I manage to sort of continue to sort of promote a narrative to some extent, while also very strongly disagreeing with a lot of the messages that were coming from the community. So a good example is silence is violence. That the moment I saw that, it irked me I just immediately knew, I mean, I am American. Compelled speech is not, so, you know, that did not sit right with me. And I even had a friend that after I had been posting almost defensively brought that up with me, and was sort of like, well, you know, I didn't post, but I don't believe that silence is violence. And, you know, I don't, you know, just very, very defensive towards me. And that was a sign to me that, even though I didn't fully, adopt all of the entire mindset or the entire set of beliefs that were being promoted, I clearly had aligned myself enough with these ideas and with this movement that people in my life were then assuming that I therefore did believe all of these things. So I didn't post anything about silence, violence. I actually strongly opposed that the whole time, but lo and behold, the people in my life, based on what I was putting out there, very much believed that that was part of my stance.
I feel like I owe you an apology for the following reason, which is that we had a 5 or 6 year, like, close friendship, having deep political debates at bars and just really digging into what each other thought. And we had this, like, relationship, right? That was built on this.
And no topic was off limits.
And in particular, all the off limit topics for other conversations were the topics that we wanted to talk about, right?
Like 100%.
And I love that. Mm-hmm. And then I had this moment, I was sitting in Kits, and your name came up, and I was talking to some friends about like this, because we should also say this was a movement that took over half of my friend group simultaneously. Yes, so it is by no means just you. It was it was a wave. It was like like half of my friend wall on Instagram was posting about how crappy COVID is, and the other half is posting about how, like, systemic racism is crushing the throat of half of the American population. And when I saw a couple posts of yours, what I should have done is remember our conversations. But what I instead did was immediately put you in the other camp. Mm. I was like, oh, she's gone woke. That's a shame. I hope she comes back. But
you had a life ring, but you decided not to throw it.
and I didn't I did the thing that is so easy to do, which is it's not, like you were saying, a complex set of ideas which you can subscribe to some of and reject others. I simplified with a single label and just said, woke, too bad, not someone I can talk to anymore. And that's obviously bullshit. But I did that. And so for that, I just wanted to say I apologize, basically, because, like, we had a better friendship than that.
I don't hold it against you. We hadn't spoken in a little while up to that point anyway. And I think that is precisely what is so dangerous about this particular set of ideas, is that embedded in this whole mentality is this idea that if you question someone on these ideas, you may be labeled a racist, you may be labeled a Nazi, who knows? Even someone who isn't white could be called racist, which, I mean, in the context of everything, is kind of bizarre. And we were seeing examples of that everywhere, of people getting called out just for questioning things, people losing their jobs very publicly, reputations completely tarnished. And so what I view as so dangerous about aligning with particularly that group, and, well, again, that group, that set of ideas, is precisely that, is that the root of it all was like, this is truth. And if you question this, there's a price to pay. So no wonder I didn't seem to be approachable. You know, a lot of, like I said, a lot of what I was posting was really specifically the issue of police brutality. And another sort of interesting behavioral move that I made was that I the whole time I was very aware of the statistics. Mm. This is what is so confusing for me to unpack, is the emotional hold of seeing all of these videos and knowing, but knowing, you know, it's, and I didn't post a single video of police being brutal towards a white person, for example. And one that this just, it, that goes completely against my whole theory of how you make change, which is to get as many people on your side as possible. And I do think that there's truth behind the police in America have a long way to go. And there are a lot of things that I think are problematic in their training, possibly in their hiring and recruiting and the unionized. We can go on and on about all of the problems. But the point is, it actually affects everyone. And so I was aware of that. And yet I felt that if I was to post anything about, who's the guy in Texas?
Tony Timba.
Yeah. That if I was to post anything like that, that I would be sort of, villainized maybe by the woke left, which I would say I know a couple of people who are friends who are very much in that space. And I wasn't talking to them personally during the time, but they were posting. And I specifically remember posting videos and then as they were loading, taking them down and thinking, ooh, how is that going to look? But it was very, it's just interesting that I couldn't zoom out quite far enough, in those moments. Very, very bizarre to try to actually recount this because I knew the same things that I know now.
Yeah, the statistics point is a fascinating one because
which statistics, first of all.
Yeah, I mean, it resonates with me hard though. So, I mean, you know, all this stuff starts unfolding and, you know, it's disturbing and, you know, it's taking up everyone's day to day. And so, naturally, as just like a nerd, I start pulling up statistics on like crimes and police shootings and trying to wrap my head around like what the hell is going on here. And I didn't know, one, if that was a common reaction, because it did seem like a lot of the narrative on social media was sort of out of touch with what I thought were like pretty basic statistics on how this stuff happens. And I mean, so for my part, like when you look up the statistics, it seems like a couple things jumped out. One was that there is, in terms of like incarceration and stuff, there seems to be like a massive problem when it comes to especially the African-American community in the United States. Like that is like just punches you in the face when you look that up, and it's like horrifying and gut-wrenching. But when it comes to like police interaction in particular, it didn't seem like we had robust evidence that African-Americans were being killed more than anyone else. But they were being harassed more.
Well, they were having more encounters. They have more encounters per capita. And so then you have to ask the question, why?
Why? Exactly. So, you know, I'm looking at all these and then you're trying to wrap your head around, like all these questions are going through your mind, right? You're looking at numbers and then you're trying to contextualize them. You're trying to ask like, could there be bias in the numbers? Like, you know, what else could account for this? Like, you know, what's going on here? And then you go to, so like I went to two protests actually that were happening in Palo Alto. Remember thinking that I had like very specific reasons for being there. So I found like certain arguments compelling. I found like maybe, you know, if the communities that are being most hurt by violence are asking for like a different sort of police structure, right? Like maybe more of that funding is put into like community health or something. So my political views was just like, hey, we should try that. Right. If like communities that are suffering are asking for like a different setup, I think we should do that. And then like, thinking about the American prison system and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm walking into these protests with very specific reasons for being there. And but then what sort of the weird thing about a protest is it's like the bluntest possible political instrument there is, right? And so sometimes they're super useful, right? And like protests should happen. I think protest is probably a very healthy part of a democracy, right? And certainly justified in lots of situations. But it is true that it's very blunt because people can be there for all sorts of different reasons. And so I'd find myself like walking along mm-hmm. the streets of Palo Alto, which is ironically like, you know, one of the richest suburbs in the world. And people are like chanting things, right? So I don't know if either of you have been to these protests, but people are, you know, banging on things and chanting things. And some of the chants, I'm just like, I can't get behind this, right? This is sort of the equivalent for me of like the silence is violence. You know, there's one of the chants I remember being like, there's no good cops in a racist system. And me thinking like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, I, you know, what are we trying to say here? Like, are we trying to ascribe certain behaviors to all police based on the actions of a few police? Like, I think we have a word for that, right? Mm-hmm. We ascribe individual characteristics based at group level. And so anyway, just the whole story about, yeah, trying to dive into the statistics. And then as you're confronted with like broader narratives, right, that people are saying, it's like, it sort of loses its subtlety, but you feel sort of compelled because you're like, well, I know there is bad stuff happening. And I do want to confront that. And like, maybe the way to confront that is to just like kind of go along with like the bigger, broader narratives happening. So anyway, I just totally understand that pressure of like, well, I want to do something. No one seems to be talking about exactly what I want to talk about, but maybe there's no time for that. I just want to show that I'm like not okay with the status quo. And anyway, just the bluntness of this, of the project I was trying to engage in really hit me in the face when I was walking along these streets shouting things that I was like, this, I just don't agree with this. Like, this is, that doesn't make sense.
There's gotta be a thrill to it too, right? Like, of like being in a crowd.
Yeah.
And let's not forget being in a crowd after not being around other human beings for
a couple of months. Yeah.
Three or four months. And being a crowd who are all in agreement on the core issue, perhaps on the fringes, like if it's all police or just some police.
Right.
Yeah.
Or on like the definition of racism, maybe that's just fringe stuff, but the core value that unites everybody, that's what's really important at this pressing time, right? And I when you had said that sadness is passive and there's and anger is active, like that resonates with me so fucking hard, because I get angry and I like the anger if it can be channeled in a positive direction. And like I compare that to passive sadness. Like in my, I wouldn't have used that word or that language because it didn't occur to me, but now I'm going to because I love it so much. I completely get the mindset because there's an important issue. There's a bunch of people who all agree on the importance of the issue. There's a clearly defined bad guy or bad group, and there is a program. There's a set of things you can do to help. So it's not as if I don't know what to do. I know exactly what to do. I need to sign on to Black Lives Matter. And I need to read the literature, and I need to take the recommendations, which, like, it's not called activism by accident, right? It's an active thing. And so,
I mean, the sadness and anger that's been on my mind for the last month. I've been sort of playing around with that idea to try to understand, because what really comes from that is like, yes, it is an active emotion. Yes, it's very compelling towards action. But it is also, tends to be very tunnel vision. And so I think in one of your other podcasts, you even brought up, this idea of anger compelling you to do more research. And I've realized that just doesn't work for me. My job before I sit down to tackle an issue is to remove the anger, or at least set it aside, because I wind up in that trap of my head saying one thing, my emotions saying another, and just blatantly ignoring evidence that is there or being willing to overlook it. I mean, it's very easy to do, even if you aren't feeling emotional about a topic, take a very unemotional topic and you're going to seek out something that confirms what you already believe, or at least when something that does confirm what you believe appears, it's going to have a extra little glimmer.
It's so psychologically satisfying to just let that be the argument and then stop looking, right? Just be like, That's a good number. I'm going to look at that number. That's all I need. Let's move. Yeah, I felt that a lot, honestly, around this issue, looking at stuff just like.
Mm-hmm.
And let's, like, I think it's also important to keep this in mind in the moment. So, for example, Ben and I have been going on a big tirade about long-termism, and we're not going to talk about long-termism, but we should talk about how it's possible to fall into that trap, where we can just, research can turn into cherry picking, and cherry picking can turn into demonizing, and and
all the emails rolling in telling us we're out of our minds.
Yeah. But I only say that to echo that, like, the social justice thing is so dominant in the culture right now, so it's even easier to get wrapped up in it.
Well, it's become political leadership has completely adopted it. It's actually a bit alarming.
We have to go into that subject at some point, but I'm curious to get a sense of how much of this experience was purely social media. Like, what were your interpersonal relations like, and these kinds of conversations? And let's go into that aspect a little bit.
So I had a lot of one-on-one conversations through social media, Messenger, through, like, you know, Instagram. So I would engage in a lot of these one-on-one conversations. I would post something and somebody would respond, or vice versa. And I was really mostly engaging with people who were kind of in the same boat as myself, but they weren't as active in terms of their online presence. And a lot of that came down to community stuff. So I was talking to a lot of people from my hometown, Chattanooga. And around that time, during one of the protests, a man who, I think he had a history where he maybe under tighter gun laws wouldn't have been able to purchase firearms. And he was found on a rooftop in my hometown with just a ton of weaponry. And in theory, his plan was to take out that crowd. And I had friends who were in that crowd. And that was a very, like, ooh, that moment really got me quite fired up. And so there was a lot of conversation around that.
Sorry, just to clarify. So this would be a clear incident of, like, white domestic terrorism.
Yes. They got him before, like, no shots fired. But then the other thing that you see a lot of, which really feeds into this idea of systemic racism, it was the treatment. Well, he made it to the jailhouse for booking in one piece with no scratches, no bruises. He wasn't beaten up. He wasn't thrown on the ground. He was escorted politely to the vehicle. And, you know, how often, again, a video can really mislead you. You can watch 1,000 videos and realize that 1,000 is a pretty small number. In terms of all incidents, you know, you think you've seen a lot. You think you've really got a handle on what you're seeing, and
then you think about how many encounters there are every day. Yeah, and something.
Yeah. So I was having a lot of conversations around that. So I was getting a lot of reinforcement from my liberal friends who were living in the South, who I think were probably experiencing things similar to me, where they were horrified to see the pushback on the other side. And many of them were, like, afraid to some degree. There was a lot of sort of rekindled friendship through that as well. So I was talking to a lot of people from back home. We were commiserating on what was going on, and we were kind of feeding into each other's thought process.
Because it wasn't people reaching out to say, hey, I disagree.
Not one.
Right.
Not one.
I was one of those not ones because I was scared. I was legitimately like, I don't know if we could talk about this. And I had a moment of, I should reach out to see if Marianne's doing okay. And then I was too scared to. I legitimately was.
Yeah.
And so that must have just fed back into this echo chamber effect. Terribly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I did create it myself. But again, that to me is the real danger of this particular movement, is that it is a
ideology.
It's kind of scary. Yeah, it's an ideology. It's disagreement is punishable. And as we've seen, it's punishable in a very real way for a lot of people.
And not only disagreement, but non-participation is punishable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not participating. Yeah. I saw a lot of commentary early on of people jumping on influencers and celebrities who are posting pictures of themselves enjoying a lovely beach vacation. Mm. And how dare they not post a black square? Like, these people are enjoying their... This was the dialogue that I was seeing. And I was sort of thinking, like, well, I mean, there are other things happening. I mean, this actually isn't the only thing. And then I thought of some of my other friends, and I was like, I actually don't know if these people do know what's going on. Like, I don't think that they are staying up with current events enough to even know. These are people in the Caribbean and whatnot. I think part of what's interesting about that is, like, I think we're so drawn to having a group and having like a tribe of people and a community. And that was a very hard community to, I didn't get a lot of comfort from that. I felt it was like, even though there wasn't anybody specifically sort of policing me, I felt like I was walking on eggshells. I would post things all the time and delete them before they actually hit the stage, because I was questioning myself, and from both sides. While I was posting what I did believe at the time, and there are things that I disagree with that I posted then, I guess now I'm circling back in my own mind to this idea of, like, would I say I was radicalized or not? Mm-hmm. Could anybody who was viewing me, or even anybody who was seeing me in person during that time, I think would say, yes, I was radicalized. Or at least I had a radical, but again, as you said, radical was normal for a minute there. Totally.
I'd say half of the population was radicalized.
NPR was supporting looting. And
The CDC. Yeah.
I saw, just completely off topic, I saw a hilarious Photoshopped image of, like, the January 6th. Riots of someone photoshopped that the book by the woman who had wrote, like, In Defense of Looting. So they wrote this, photoshopped that into the hand of one of the rioters during the January 6th shenanigans. And I was like, I don't think NPR will be
covering this story
on that side. So I'm curious, like, what your interaction with that community, for lack of a better word, looks like now. So it sounds like you're still sympathetic to, like, some of the claims and stuff being made there, just not to other ones. But you know, if like membership in this group requires, like, a complete buy-in, like 100% agreement with all the tenants, like, what is sort of a productive engagement with it look like, right? And so I'm just curious, like, how are you interfacing with people you met during that time now? Or, like, is it just, are you completely kind of shut off from that? Or,
well, I mean, I certainly haven't, none of my friendships have changed. Like, I haven't like let go of any friends. And most of who I was following and sort of like the leadership of some of this movement, whether it was Black Lives Matter or different people in the social justice realm, I wasn't directly interacting with them. So it was more that I was just consuming. I was consuming their content, accepting whatever simplified version could be fit into a cartoon with a couple words and reposting it.
that's a good point. Like, how much of this do you think was driven by the fact that people were not having face-to-face conversations with each other as much as they would have been during normal times? Because, like, yeah, I live in California, so it's, you know, I'm around a lot of this, a lot of the time. Mm. And I find, like, people in person tend to be, like, super reasonable. We can see eye to eye on, like, most issues, agree that, like, change is warranted in some areas. Burning things down is probably not the way to get it done. You know, people are, like, very receptive to just, like, gentle criticism, and we can disagree civilly and everything's fine. Right. And then social media is, you know, I see them on Twitter doing other things. And so I'm curious, like, do you think, how much of this do you think was just because people were so online and like so plugged in and just not, they weren't having like the face-to-face feedback mechanism of like real conversation?
I think that's what it was. I mean, I think that it almost fully existed online. And even what was happening at the protests was, it started online, happened in person, and then was recirculated online. Everything was through that. And you know, I think with the distrust of media that is, or mainstream media that's sort of ever growing from both sides, a lot of the content that I think was being put out there at the time were videos that people had just taken themselves on their phones. And of course, the problem with that is, at what point in the course of events did you get to tune in?
Right.
You know, and at what point did the video end and what happened after? Because when you see when you see a video or you see something and you can safely assume it wasn't like digitally doctored, it's kind of like, well, what better evidence could you possibly have? Like, it's right there. I can see it. I can see it with my own eyes. It's right there. And so I think that that really messed with people's understanding of truth, especially if you were fired up and angry and you already had this mindset that not only are police this terrible problem on society, but that, you know, the majority of them are bad.
Yeah, well, I wanted to kind of start talking about the ascendancy out now, because I feel like we've explored the getting in and the swirling around. Then you take a 2-3 month hiatus from social media. Was that also a hiatus from the internet and like computers and screens and just the whole entire subject, or was it still a process of like working through these ideas and doing, or was it just like cold turkey? Or
it was cold turkey. No, I'm not. And I would open my Instagram app just to see if there was a message, and I would engage. There are a couple of friends that don't use Messenger and we chat through there, so normal conversation, but otherwise cold turkey, no scrolling. No, I kind of avoided the topic altogether. I also took on a really big personal project that became like the perfect blessing for that time. I got completely wrapped up in it. I was just experiencing what I wish I had been experiencing while I was in this mess, which is that I had a positive thing to focus on, really, that provided some fulfillment. And all of that sort of coincided with taking a bit of a closer look at where I was at. I started doing some pretty simple, straightforward things. I just started meditating. I started using Sam Harris's app, which I would say, and I really started doing that daily, and would say it's very much a ritual now, closer to December. And the power of that tool to be able to disconnect your identity from your thoughts. You know, I think a bit, there was a chunk of time there, sometime between the fall and now, where I once again was in a situation where I couldn't quite face myself, because now I was sort of faced with this other problem, which was like, okay, I've now gone around spewing all of these ideas that I don't even know I fully believe in, and I probably spew them very irresponsibly because I'm painting a picture that is very incomplete. And now I have to confront myself, that, you know, confront the fact that I did that. And that that's kind of how I presented myself to the world for a hunk of time, which came with a lot of guilt and shame, of course. And daily meditation, honestly, was the ticket for me, because I needed to be able to, to be able to really process this and look at it clearly. And I guess look at it honestly, you know, to be able to really fully critique myself and say, yeah, you completely ignored the information in your brain for a feeling, a negative feeling, or a negative state of being. I needed permission to separate who I am from my thoughts, my ideas. And once I was really able to settle into that and understand that concept or really embody that concept, it became very easy for me to then get curious about what had happened instead of critical.
I think you have succeeded in doing the thing that I've been really trying to figure out for a long time, which is like, what's the relationship between meditation and epistemology? And like, I meditate too, not as much as I should, but you learn the skill of separating yourself from your thoughts. And the way that you had then noticed that that is maybe the first step to separating your identity from your ideas. And that is the next step to becoming more open to criticism and changing your mind. And that's just a really fascinating connection because that is so unbelievably important to the ability to start thinking through issues yourself, right? Because you want to be able to entertain an idea and have batted around with some friends and then realize it wasn't as strong as you thought and then entertain another one. But your ideas are not your personhood or your self-worth.
Nor are they necessarily reflective of your values.
Right.
Like your core values. You know, like my, you know, one of my core values is that I genuinely dislike unnecessary suffering for others. And most people would say that they don't think that people should be treated differently because of qualities that they can't control, and that that might be somewhere woven into their value system. Ideas of how to deal with that problem in our society are, you know, that can look a million different ways.
And, so. And should, I think, is one of the things that started to make me nervous about some of the rhetoric that you're pointing out, is like, not just the focus on certain ideas is the right ones, because I think that is very natural with like any, you know, like I have strong opinions about all sorts of subjects. And of course, I think I'm right.
Wouldn't have the opinion if you didn't.
Yeah, exactly. But I get, the problem is like thinking that other opinions are not just wrong, but dangerous, right? That we can't have the other opinions in the room. And it's that sort of attitude, which is super harmful, I think, to the very communities that we're trying to help, right? Because we need as many ideas as possible. We want contrarian voices because we might be missing something. We want, you know, we want all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life contributing ideas for like how to help some of the most disadvantaged people. And so assuming that we just have the right answer right away and not assuming that we can't be wrong, like that, you know, we have to get rid of the police, that's it, and as soon as we do that we'll have achieved some sort of heaven on earth, right, is super, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's harmful to the very people we're trying to help here.
And I think the problem gets even worse, because not only do you assume that your ideas are right, but you assume that the other people have the same idea. Right, you assume that the other disadvantaged group all have one idea, and that's that the Washington Redskins is a racist logo or whatever. Like you create a group that you are trying to defend, and then you superimpose upon them your views about what you think they think, and then you don't accept that they could have a different opinion. So, for example, Coleman Hughes, John McWhorter, Glenn Lowry, the names of Black dissident thinkers who are essentially ostracized from mainstream political opinion because they don't hold the set of views that NPR holds. And therefore they can't be like true Black people. They can't they can't be also speaking for their community. No, they're speaking for,
they've sold out.
It's just this broadcasting of simplifying assumptions on groups of human beings, and you're doing it because you want to help them.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that made me the most uncomfortable during this months long ordeal is that I was looking at surveys actually that were done like while this was happening, and then the data was available like, you know, a couple months afterwards of surveys of like people in these communities about their opinions of the police, like what they wanted to do. And there was a lot of it's not that all relations with the police are good, far from it, right? There are a lot of problems with policing in these communities, but by no means was it 90% that we need to get rid of the police and that will solve all our problems, like not even close. And so this assumption from ironically like liberal elites sort of, right? It is just like, we know what's best for these communities, a priori, you know, without testing things, without asking them. And it's very paternalistic, honestly. And that's not to say I have the right answer or they know, or we know it's going to work, right? We have to try a lot of things.
Well, you know, I remember when I first sort of started to stand behind the defund the police slogan, and I was reposting that specifically. I wasn't standing with an abolish the police mindset, but I was posting some things that were very emotionally flared that could easily have indicated that. And when I was posting some of this defund the police stuff, it was like, I remember saying to somebody like, well, we've been doing it our way or something along these lines. Like, we've been doing it this way for so long and it clearly hasn't worked. Why can't we listen to what Black people are saying? Why can't we try this proposed method without really realizing, like, you know, I guess what I was trying to voice was like, we need to listen to the Black community. It's like, well, who in the Black community?
Yeah.
Right. Because
there's a lot of different
the loudest voices are not necessarily the true representatives. In fact, there are no true representatives. The idea that there's a position of that is an illusion. And so, you know, looking back, it feels quite silly because then it very much became like, well, I know what's right for these communities based on the supposed wishes of this community, which again kind of falls back into that kind of paternalistic, like, now I know what's best, but it's based on, I'm claiming that it's based on the recommendations of this community, but even many members of this community are very outwardly opposed. And I don't know if I'm referring to the same set of surveys, but I saw a set of surveys on this and there were many Black people who wanted a greater police presence in their communities and felt that the presence itself was lacking.
Has anyone followed up on Minneapolis?
Oh, Minneapolis, they didn't abolish. So they were going to abolish the police. They were going to get rid of the police. That didn't go through. I'm not sure if they succeeded in just cutting their budget or something. That's possible, but they definitely didn't end up abolishing it. I don't know if...
That is a perfect example of the fear that may have taken over people who are not really buying into all of this is what happened to the mayor, who has expressed great sympathy throughout all of this and really seemed genuinely committed to pushing for police reform. And when they... I don't know if you guys saw the video of him at one of the protests, and he was called upon by some of the Black Lives Matter leaders who were at this specific protest to assure them that he was going to help them dismantle and abolish the police. And he said, I'm working on everything I can, but I just can't do this. I'm sorry. And they're berating him. And he just sort of hangs his head and he's just booed and ostracized by the crowd, and they're yelling at him and calling him all sorts of, and it's like, this is one of the most sympathetic politicians to the entire cause at the time. And the moment he didn't fall in line with the, you know, the absolutes, he was out.
Yeah, fascinating. It is sort of the back to the sort of narcissism of small differences, right? Like we can have people who are all sympathetic to trying to like improve the lives of people in these communities, but you know, it's those minor details that we that just like split the difference and then kind of make the whole project less effective, unfortunately, because it just kind of eats itself from the inside.
We have been not talking politics, I think, both because I didn't want to interweave the personal discussion with the political one, mm-hmm. but I do think it's like super important to go into the politics. So like, what are your views now?
Oh, wow.
And specifically the defund the police right. slogan, movement, idea.
Yeah. So that's an interesting one because, what you were talking about earlier, Ben, about, the ACAB rhetoric, all cops are bastards.
That's good.
That was something that I actually kind of did subscribe, like mm-hmm. prescribe to. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I really, was compelled towards that viewpoint was that I sort of adopted this mentality of like, well, you know, there's so many, things that, police officers do that are part of their everyday job, that result in, disproportionate effects on different minority communities. And, even taking this job on, you know that you are going to have, this was my mentality at the time. You know that you're going to have to do something immoral, that you're going to be doing things that are more harmful than helpful as part of your job. And therefore taking that job in and of itself is problematic. So that was one viewpoint that I had sort of slipped into. Of course, seeing what happened in Buffalo, New York, where there was an elderly, man who, went up to a group of the police. He was pushed over. His head was bleeding. Nobody checked on him. The entire force that was on call at the time just walked by him. When the officers deemed responsible were reprimanded, I believe the entire police force either quit or publicly threatened to quit. And that was a very reinforcing moment for me too, because here we had an entire police force. And of course, the entire police force wasn't necessarily, they weren't all, again, like the reasons why they would stand up for fellow officers could be much more complex. I mean, they might have hated those individuals. We don't know, but the reasons were probably more complex than I was giving credit to. So in my mind, the majority of police officers I thought maybe had, like over 50%, I thought maybe had some sort of problematic personality traits, problematic character, had these sort of ideas about who these people were. And then in addition to it, I saw this sort of hierarchical system where, well, obviously the people who are running the show went through the ranks in a similar fashion. And this was a moment where I really started to say like, oh, the police force is systemically racist. That was a viewpoint that I held without even really tearing apart the actual systemic part of it. Mm-hmm. And so my thought was, well, and this was, I was sort of echoing what I was hearing, was, well, we can't give these people more money. All we've ever done is continue to fund police. I mean, I was looking up like city records to see police budgets and saying, look how much money they're spending on these new Dodge Chargers. Mm-hmm. This is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. They should be spending this money, you know? And so I was really going down this, this rabbit hole of like, this is an incredibly corrupt system and the methods for training, et cetera. Now my viewpoint is very, very different. I'm maybe an advocate for more funding. I'm definitely an advocate for more training. Mm. And I'm actually leaning towards, although I'm only just exploring this idea now, this idea that banning chokeholds is actually, not a good idea. Banning these, opportunities to control someone through your bodily force, as opposed to a weapon, right, yeah, is possibly a better tool. And so my viewpoints have shifted because I've mostly just sort of started looking at the cause and effect, you know? So my solution of defund the police, while I could sort of logically explain it at the time, it was full of resentment. No, it was full of punishment. It was punishment, resentment. It was not properly focused on an actual solution that was well thought out. Mm. I certainly hadn't thought it out well enough.
I feel like you may be giving yourself a bit of too hard of a time, though, because take away the politics, take away the movement, take away all of it. And when faced with a problem like this, often the first idea that occurs is let's try to start again. Mm. And just like, this is a big problem. Perhaps we just need to start over. Mm. And I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that per se. It's kind of like the first idea, and then we interrogate it and see if it holds up, and then move to new ideas.
Mm. Well, I mean, in the spirit of the name of this podcast, I do see some problem with it, because when you call for such a radical sort of wiping the slate clean, and then you replace it with whatever you replace it with, it becomes very hard to measure what went right, what went wrong, what negative effects that come out of the new solution are a result of the new solution or from not having the old solution. There's no way to measure. And if we you run the risk of creating new problems or undoing the good work that has been done up to this point. So I don't think it's a good starting off point. I think good starting off points stay somewhere within the realm of where we are right now, understanding that where we are right now is better than where we were. And we need to do everything that we can to not reintroduce the problems of the past to the new solution.
Do you have an opinion? So you mentioned you were looking at like budgets and stuff, and yeah, I had some friends who were doing the same thing. And admittedly, like, yeah, I know nothing about this, but some of the budgets did seem huge. Like there were some like cities that were spending like 40% or something on like police related activities, which seems like a lot, but I have no idea. So I'm curious if you have an opinion on like sort of the trade-off between more like policing infrastructure and like say like more resources dedicated towards like community health, like mental health services and like other forms of social services that might mitigate some of the problems to begin with.
Like the idea that if we have like a pie and our pie is only so big, how much of it should we reasonably be giving to the police, and how much should we be in, I guess the term was reinvesting in communities.
Yeah, exactly. So whatever that looks like.
That's got to be so community by community based. I mean, it can't possibly, it's like, you can't, I don't know what Stamford, Connecticut pays for their police force, but they certainly don't need the police presence that parts of LA need. So I don't know. I don't quite know how to make sense of that on a not.
Yeah, great. That's a great answer. Yeah.
But it is interesting, because it's like, In an area with higher crime, you have a higher police presence, and yeah, it's like, well, what's the threshold there? If let's say that there is a fixed amount of money that can go towards all of these problems, it's like there's got to be some point where the police presence, you're no longer getting that return on investment, and it would be, you know.
I don't know if either of you heard one of Sam Harris's recent podcast conversations. So Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, they're now starting to make training programs for police officers to teach police officers how to use non-violent, or not, sorry, I should say non-lethal restraint techniques, because Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is all about controlling the body of the person who doesn't want to be controlled.
And being able to control somebody who is potentially much larger and stronger than you. Mm-hmm. I did listen to that podcast, and I found it like incredibly compelling. That was something that I actually shared with a couple of people that I felt comfortable. It's very sympathetic towards the, have you listened to that podcast?
No, I haven't.
No, I recommend it. It is really it just really highlights how ill prepared police officers are, and that to me the biggest thing is training. And I think I have I feel pretty compelled towards more mental health support for, and I don't mean group therapy sessions with with the guys and, you know, whatever that looks like. But specifically after incidents, you know, because there's a very big difference between money going towards training and money going towards things. You know, do we need, if more police officers wore body cameras, like how many millions of dollars are we going to invest in body cams when police can turn them off? And there doesn't to be a lot, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of repercussion for doing so, because it was an accident. And I've seen a lot of videos or had a lot of audio like that, where people have gone up and said, why is your body camera off? And they've sort of smugly looked and said, I guess it just got knocked. You know, and this, so it's like, that. You know, and when that's this really all happens, there's this like, well, if every cop just wore a body cam, and there's a lot captured on body camera footage. It's also quite difficult to see what's happening on body camera footage, usually during an incident, because, you know, attached here, and it's the movement.
So body cameras don't work. That's really interesting. I didn't know that, but that makes sense.
Well, it's not that they don't work. Because there has been a lot of body camera footage released that has been very damning, but
I guess the
officer can turn it off.
So, yeah.
I mean, if you imagine like you're walking around and you have your camera on and you're expected to have it on, and you go to use the washroom, you're going to turn it off. And so it would be very easy to say that it would be very easy to accidentally leave it off.
Right.
But also, I imagine it's something that needs to be charged regularly. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of reasons why the return on that investment might not be as good as we think it would be.
Like if you fall into the ocean face first, like why are you going to turn it? You don't want that body camera on, you know?
Yeah.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah. The other thing that really stood out for me in that Sam Harris conversation, it was almost as if someone just like opened the window and there was just like a fresh of breath air, because once you start looking for solutions that don't circle around the word racism, then you can start trying to tackle the problem in more innovative ways. And I thought that the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu was just a new idea, and it was so refreshing just to hear new solutions being proposed that weren't monomaniacally focused on this one concept as the root of all of our current problems. Two other examples come to mind. John McWhorter. One is emphasis on phonics. So I guess there's two modes of teaching reading. One is the whole word method, and other is syllables. And so I think the phonics method is a much more successful means by which you can teach students to read. But yet many communities in certain neighborhoods aren't using that method. Second example he gives is 5-year free and reversible contraception to any woman who wants it in the United States. And the motivation behind this is that there's a lot of poor people who say they want the contraception, but just don't have the money to do it. And 5-year reversible is important because it's kind of like a set it and forget it, and then reevaluate in 5 years after you're 5 years older. And he constantly brings these two examples up in talks, because they're not sexy, they're not sloganistic, but they work.
I mean, literacy and single motherhood, if you know that information, you can make some predictions.
And so I just give them as examples of what can happen when we just start thinking about the problem in slightly different ways. And that's one of the problems with this whole wokeness, is that it's just so stifling. Like, you just have to continuously argue about definitions of racism, and if every action is just interpreted through the lens of racism, and then you just take your side, and now we're arguing about critical race theory, and we're not talking about people who are in dire need of help.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think identity politics was already well underway before all of this happened, and it's just sort of added more fuel to the fire. I mean, that was a real moment for me. I had a friend ask me, this was more recently, because we were having a conversation about all this, and She was like, how would you feel if somebody was constantly yelling at you? Your life matters. Just yelling it at you. And just
so good.
Like, but, so good. Like, do you need, like, and again, part of my undoing was remind, you know, I had to remind myself, like, I am a woman. And I've spent a lot of time working in male dominated industries, and my preference is to just not have to think about my gender. I don't want to be celebrated for being a woman because I can't control that. And I don't want to experience any different treatment because of it as well. But we are at a place where you get brownie points for things that you can't control, and you get dinged for things that you can't. And I've heard a lot of people who are older than us and who lived through the civil rights era describe this as like, we have gone back to a time where we are telling children that one of the most important features about them is the color of their skin. And although it doesn't look the same way, I mean, it is really quite disturbing.
Something that I have been thinking about in relation to the fact that Helena and I are having a daughter, and she is going to be...
I knew you were having a kid, but I didn't know you were having a girl.
Yeah, we just found that out a week ago. But at a certain point, she's going to be taught that she's privileged by her teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to happen in grade school. And then she's going to be taught to look to her left and her right. And some of the boys and girls with darker skin are less privileged than her. But because she's one quarter Indian, she presumably has 3/4 of the amount of privilege as somebody who is not. This is disgusting. And this is inevitable given how these concepts are taught in school and in government. And I was just looking at a course which Helena, as a social worker, has to take. And you can imagine what's in it. And this is government legislated time that she has to put in because this is how they want her to think. Right? This is at the government level. It's at the school level. And so these ideas are around, and they're just seeming to be growing in popularity. But I think people are just so terrified to say anything about them that they just kind of let them keep creeping into every aspect of their lives. So I don't really know what to do with that, except just to say that I think that this conversation is so valuable because this is not just some hypothetical thing. This is quite real. And it's, you can look at the Dave Rubins and the Ben Shapiros and think that it's just some conservative talking point, and they go too far on the other side. And we have to trim down the excesses there too. But there is a real problem here to be discussed. And but it's just, it's something that I'm, here's another personal detail. So I guess I'm technically a person of color, but I just find that to be such a repulsive term. It's like you take that term and you remove the of, flip the order, and now it's pure racism, colored person. But if you undo it and put it of in between, then it's some gentle way to refer to others. And like the only time I ever refer to my skin color is when talking to people who are further to the left than me. And that is a tragedy because, like, I think all of us have a deep affinity for the left. I think we all have like this part in our heart that feels like we're liberals, that we're lefties. At least I feel this way. Like I would never identify as a conservative, but I would still identify as a liberal, although the term is just now so associated with ideas that I don't hold. And so if I could just have everything as it was, I would want the left to heal itself, you know, because it's a part of like my heritage, and that just makes it even the more difficult to discuss, because you, like, you don't want to criticize your friends, you don't want to criticize your team, but yet I think it's the obligation of all of us who abhor racism and who abhor thinking about others based on superficial characteristics.
It's as if it's become mainstream because we're seeing it in institutions, we're seeing it in government, but I don't think anybody really has a clear hand. Well, I know that there are polls, but I don't feel like I have a good grasp on how many people really believe this, how many people have adopted it, how many people are maybe where I was with certain issues where they just like, just kind of go along with this. I think people who are opposed to it, people who are very opposed to it are tend to be very vocal, but I was speaking to a friend just last week, and much to my relief, we were both able to admit to each other that we tune into Ben Shapiro's podcast. And it was almost like,
people say it in hushed tones.
Were we just able to like say that we are willing to admit that it's possible that, well, for one, I mean, I just want to hear both sides. But there are many people who would be appalled that you would even tune in, even if you said, well, I mostly disagree with him, but I feel that it's my responsibility to try to understand the other side's point of view. It's that whole concept of giving someone a platform. I mean, I'm going to be entering a career field where I know that I will probably be seen as a diversity hire because there are so few women in the field that I'm in. That doesn't make me happy. Like, I don't think like, oh, great, now I'm going to get my piece of, you know, and I also don't feel like that there's any like level of justice there, because I don't think that there is a lack of women in my field solely for the reason of sexism and the patriarchy.
Yeah.
And I would equate the same with race.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to feel about affirmative action type policies for precisely this reason. So on the one hand, I am sympathetic with like diversity arguments, especially given like the uneven distribution of like wealth and things like this and opportunity among the population, right? So I think there can be some good arguments for things like affirmative action to try and also just from an ideas perspective, I think in a lot of fields we want a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds with different ideas about how things work. So from that perspective, I think like diversity efforts and stuff are valuable. But then there's this riddle where it's like, so I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of someone who's like from like a disadvantaged community or a minority community or something, whether it's like race or class or something. And then I think like, okay, suppose there were affirmative action policies in place, whether it's, you know, at a collegiate level or a job level. Would I want to think that even if it wasn't, right, but suppose those policies are in place, I want to have this like psychological doubt in my abilities that my being there, whether it's, you know, job or college, is due only to like some superficial characteristic as opposed to like the work I put in or something? And so I'm honestly not sure how to feel about this. Like, obviously I can't put myself in the shoes of someone like that, but I have a suspicion that I would not want to feel like that. I think that would make me super uncomfortable to think that my presence somewhere was like only because like not because of the work or the papers I've published or the ideas I've had, but just because of like my wealth at birth or something, or my parents' wealth at birth. And so anyway, this is just to confess my confusion about some of these these policies.
So I've learned a lot from John McWhorter on this particular subject. And so he makes two, I think, very interesting points. The first one is he kind of equates race-based affirmative action with chemotherapy in the sense that, say, after the civil rights movement, 60s and the end of like Jim Crow and all that, he recognizes that there was a role for race-based affirmative action because there was such a gross inequity that had to do something. But it is a very intense intervention like chemotherapy, which should be seen as like last resort and a finite thing, which can quickly become unhelpful and dangerous. And so he often reformulates the question of, do we think affirmative action is a good thing or a bad thing? Do we think affirmative action should last forever? And if not, when do you think it should stop?
Yeah. When do we know that we've reached, is it when, our governments have the exact matching proportion percentage of Latin women as are in the population and Jewish men. And at what point do we, how many categories can you create? And when you're talking about these topics, like you can't go into race without then saying potentially, well, this is the situation for Black people. But this is the situation for Black men. And this is the situation for Black women. And this is the situation for Black transgender women. And so the, I guess it's the sort of intersectionality argument out of it all. I just don't buy that there really is a defined endpoint from anyone's point of view. And I would imagine that if we're still in this sort of way of thinking, that even if we did kind of achieve what we maybe initially set out to achieve, that a new set of categories would then be created to even further
bifurcate.
I mean, I've certainly feel like I've seen that in the LGBTQ community. It's interesting that I didn't have this sort of self-reflection going through everything last summer, because there are some parallels there. I've always felt incredibly disconnected from the LGBTQ community. But the parallel I would draw there is again, it comes back to this idea of like, do I really want these characteristics about myself that I have absolutely no control over to be the sort of the main things that someone sees, or to be given more significance than my views, for example? And I would imagine that a lot of people in the Black community feel that way. Yeah. Right now. And I don't even know if I like that term. I like, I don't even know what to say, like the Black community, the LGBTQ community, like what, these aren't communities. It's a huge swaths of people.
Yeah. All very different.
Living in their own
different opinions. And It's really amazing how much of like the mainstream political rhetoric revolves around talking about voting blocks comprised of like different groups of people, just defined by like these bizarre superficial characteristics, like how mainstream it is to just say like the Black vote went to the Democratic candidate, as if there's just no Glenn Lowry does not exist. He's just not a person. And it's just bizarre. The same thing with like like LGBTQ vote, right? Like they're, you know, as if everyone's gonna vote the same way, feel the same thing about it's a bizarre sort of legitimized dehumanizing rhetoric. Like it's very odd.
Dehumanizing is a great word, because that's how I feel when people think of me as a person of color. And I don't think anyone actually thinks of me as a person of color, but they just think of people of color in the abstract, in the general. And I guess I'm technically one of them, but like it's just it's so weird. Like I would never associate myself with this this label. And so when we say, like, what must people in the person of color community think? Well, here's a single data point. I think it's a fucking stupid idea. And I think it's just a weird label to aggregate everybody under the umbrella of you're not white. And that's the only characteristic that matters with this grouping, is that you aren't white. I was going to return actually to what McWhorter said about affirmative action, because I think it's related to this, which is that after making the chemotherapy point, he advocates for a class-based affirmative action rather than a race-based one.
Right.
And I think that this goes quite a long way for kind of this community purpose argument, because poor people everywhere could use a leg up. And if given a leg up and put into a university, you can't tell by looking at them if they were a poor person admin, right? So there's, you don't have that superficial characteristic, which immediately separates human beings when using race-based affirmative action, as you with class-based one. And so just a place where the class distinction might be much more useful and fruitful to think about than the race one, because obviously we all know that race correlates quite strongly with class. But really, that's what we want to be addressing, I would say, is the economic inequity. I don't know if either of you have read Hillbilly Elegy, but it's a beautiful book. And you just see the similarities between the white Appalachian, quote, hillbillies.
One of the most hardest hit areas in terms of like a never-ending cycle of poverty. And
I would just recommend to our listeners to read John McWhorter's review of Hillbilly Elegy. It's beautiful. And just the similarities between poor people everywhere is very often not remarked because it is a race-neutral way to describe demographics. And I just wanted to elevate that into the conversation a little bit because I think that can go some way to getting a lot of what we all want without succumbing to the problems.
I think that's such a great, I mean, it's almost, at least for me, it almost seems like such a subtle shift. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, we're still talking about a group of people who are in need. And you're almost, it's more precise because not all Black people need to be lifted out of
oppression.
Yes,
oppression.
Exactly.
And in
fact,
some would probably be quite offended if you attempted to do so.
It's like an unnecessary heuristic, sort of, right? It's like you're trying to help the most disadvantaged people by, and then you say, okay, this is correlated with race in some areas, but why not just talk about the most disadvantaged people? Because we have data on that. We know what that looks like, right? We have medical records. We have income records. Like, mm-hmm.
I want to pivot the conversation slightly to specifically systemic racism, because that's a subject that you and I have explored in the past. And one that I think Ben and I tried to explore in an early podcast conversation. It was just a goddamn train wreck and we never released it, which is a good thing. But anyway, so back to the notion of systemic racism, because I know that that concept is a politically fraught one and it's slightly broader. I'm super interested in the way that language is used in this world, because you have this bait and switch thing that happens where we all have these very negative emotions about racism because it's a very strong word and it conjures up physical violence and historical examples. And then we take all that anger and that vitriol and then we broaden the definition of racism to encompass everything in society that has a statistical discrepancy. And so it's this like way to grab everyone's emotions and then just broadcast it to everything.
I've been thinking about this a lot. I have come to the conclusion that despite all of my best efforts, I still don't feel confident that I understand what is meant. I mean, I think I understand what is meant in simplistic terms when somebody talks about the patriarchy or about systemic racism. But I honestly can't quite make sense of it because I can't pinpoint it. By definition, it's sort of ineffable. Something that is like, yeah, I mean, there's something very like powerful about the way that these terms have been leveraged over people. I can give a number of arguments as to why I don't quite agree with them, but it's kind of like, kind of feels like arguing against the existence of God. Despite trying to sort of understand all that is meant by those terms, I've found myself like actually quite confused by it because you can point to endless examples of racism on an individual level. So like at what point does an organization made up of individuals who a certain percentage, you know, that's not the point either. It's not about the individuals. Like calling a system racist isn't even referring to the people, because even if you do away with all of the racist people, supposedly the system itself is inherently racist. It's interesting because the system that is claimed to be systemically racist has continually throughout history tried to legally outlaw racism.
Very nice point.
That same system, I mean, imperfectly, of course, but with genuine effort. So, I don't quite know how to answer that. And I think part of the reason I struggle with that is because I have yet to formulate my own my feelings towards it, my opinion towards it, my logical thought towards it have sort of aligned in an idea that, regardless of whether, I agree with the terminology and it exists or doesn't exist, I don't think that it is a productive focus. I don't think that it's the correct lens, to be looking at things through, but I don't think that I have a well-formulated argument, that would actually sustain through a debate with someone who is well-versed on the other side. And maybe part of that is that I haven't explored it to the right depth, but I think the other part of it is that I think that it's like a moving target. And so, despite countering one aspect, it's like it shape shifts into something else. And I'm being very vague here, but
you're not being vague. You're pointing out vagueness, because that's what it is, yeah. Right? You're recognizing that this is, yes, an intrinsically vague concept, which then people fall into the trap of arguing, does it or does it not exist? Well, that question can't be answered. It's because of the vagaries, yeah, of it. Sure. Like, we can talk about, do statistical discrepancies exist? Yes. Does racism exist? Yes. Do bad policies which create statistical discrepancies exist? Yes. We can go through the list, and just removing, that's why I kind of started the question by commenting more on the use of the language, because I think that we can get a better handle on this concept when we view it more as an emotional bludgeon and less as, yeah, a well-defined, precise concept which does or doesn't exist. Because let's not forget, the word systemic was initially introduced in reference to cancer, right? You don't have a localized cancer, it's system-wide. And it's the conjoining of this term from oncology to this word, which has pure negative connotations. And now you're just dealing with a red-hot emotional set of letters. And then when you argue if this exists or not, it's like, well, we've immediately lost, because I think that it is beneficial to recognize that racism doesn't simply consist of discrete acts between individuals.
You're like, housing maybe is a good example here. Like, Thomas Chatterson Williams tweets about this.
Yeah. Or like funding for, right, your, yeah, yeah, exactly, funding, exactly, for schools. Coming from property, yeah, yeah, taxes, yeah, and the history.
So we want to recognize, yeah, that the word racism has to be broadened a little bit. I totally understand that, and we can't just be thinking of racism from like World War II. Like, the concept has to be broadened. But by broadening it too far, using a red hot emotional label like systemic racism, now this is a conversation stifler. It can also be the source of every evil that you see in the world. And so it's not only red hot, it's not only vague, it's not only containing some aspects of truth to it to make it more complicated, but it's also something which can be applied everywhere. And that is so dangerous, because you have the single answer.
Well, and the problems themselves become hard to track, right? So now it's like, it's very unclear where to focus our attention, right? So we stop talking about, like you said, like funding of schools and how to fix like redlining issues, like, and that the legacy that comes out of that, right? And now we don't know what to focus on, because everything is an instance of this, of racism. And so now we're just like running around, and we don't know what to do. And so it takes away attention and energy from like very concrete problems.
I think maybe what you're looking for, Vaden, is, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're looking for that, like, some term that falls in the middle, something that because systemic doesn't seem to be the proper descriptor. But to just say that individual racism exists, and that's the extent of our racism problem in culture today, is obviously doesn't.
No, that's not what I'm looking for. Because to have a term that's in the middle would mean that there is a concept which is clearly defined, which I want to label with a term. but I don't think there exists such a concept. I think that there are multiple concepts, which I want multiple terms for, and I just want to recognize that this particular label is now no longer associated to an idea. So like when I think about words, I think about word attached to idea. And this can often become separate, where now you just have a word and it's not attached to any idea. And that's why you can't make sense of it, because the sense, there's nothing to make sense of, because it will continuously change form. And thinking about words as just labels, like sticky notes, like literally something you would slap on a bottle of ketchup, except instead of ketchup, it's a concept. And the word is just the label for that. And then recognizing that this can be separate, I think goes a long way to making sense of the usage of terms like institutional racism, structural racism, systemic racism. And let's not forget, there's like a bit of intellectual frisson that you get when you like hear this for the first time, because it sounds like sophisticated. It sounds nuanced. It sounds
Like a package deal. It's like the language that has sort of been floating around over the last, and I mean, it goes far beyond last summer, or further back than last summer, obviously. We were talking about this when we met up a couple of weeks ago about the, it's very easy to identify somebody who is in this sort of social justice world. And I say that mostly because of my own personal experience. And being able to stand here now and say, like, I don't think that I can even properly define what systemic racism is even supposed to mean, let alone what it meant to me when I was saying it at the time. It has become just such a sign of solidarity with the moral high ground.
Like ally. What's so fascinating to me is that, like, I can take paragraphs from friends of mine who are currently under this spell, and I can swap them amongst these various people, and there's no voice, there's no individual anything. It's like something that Christopher Hitchens and Martin Amis would constantly point out, just to be so ashamed when you use a cliche. And Martin Amis's book is called The War Against Cliche. And it sounds silly, but it's for this reason, especially when you're a writer, because it's so easy to start by just saying once upon a time. And now you're not thinking at a word level, you're thinking at a slogan level, you're thinking at a phrase level. It's like you have these, I think Orwell's term is like a picket fence. You just put giant slogans next to each other and concatenate them, rather than trying to think at the granularity of words. You think at the granularity of slogans, and it's something that I'm just constantly watching in myself and in others to see how easily they will use words they haven't thought about. And that can happen when you start becoming complacent with your use of cliches and phrases that you hear from others.
Well, social media is, I mean, social media is like where that, because, you know, you have like a little square to make a post that is supposed to pack a punch.
Focus on words is like my first filter in myself when I don't understand something, because I'll often just like repeat something I've heard other people say in the appropriate circumstance, especially in the, like, machine learning too. Like the word model is used a lot. And for a while, the word posterior in reference to a particular mathematical thing. There is a period in my life when I knew when I was supposed to say that word, and I would get the appropriate reaction from people around me, which is like a nod, but I didn't actually know what it meant. I legitimately did not know what it meant. Like, I just knew that it was the thing that we wanted to solve
this
for.
It's like the knowledge is power Francis Bacon thing.
And I would just say it though.
Have you seen that post about knowledge is power, Francis Bacon?
No, this one's good. So the context is, there's a quote, knowledge is power, and it was, I guess, written by Francis Bacon, but somebody misunderstood Francis Bacon to think it meant France space is space Bacon. And so this person would say knowledge is power and get like solemn nods from people around. And then he'd say, France is Bacon. People would, just like nod with deep profundity. And it wasn't until he or she were in their late life that they realized that they didn't understand what Francis Bacon meant.
You know, on the flip side, having words and having phrases that are easily recognizable, having jargon within a certain field is necessary. And so where that, I guess, goes astray is when the person using that word is being, I guess, intellectually lazy.
Super excellent point. I use cliches and phrases all the time. And Steven Pinker does a nice job of this, I've noticed, where he'll intentionally use certain phrases, but he'll do it at the end of making a complicated point. Mm. So as a way to try to wrap a new idea in language that he can be sure that others have used before, he will invoke common phrases to hammer something new in. So it isn't to say that cliches and phrases are bad. It's just to say that we should be careful we're not invoking them unconsciously, or even semi-consciously is fine. But as an intellectual exercise, it's always just worthwhile to say, can I phrase this differently? Sometimes the answer is I can't, so I'm going to use a cliche. Mm-hmm. But that one step, that one thought of can I say this in a slightly different manner? I think goes a long way to just preventing certain ideas from flowing through you thoughtlessly. We could talk for hours, but I wanted to make sure that we didn't leave out one other subject, which is how to help friends and family who may be going through something similar. Because I've encountered 3 people who have emailed me personally saying they've completely lost touch with a close member of their family. Mm. How do you reach someone who is right in the middle of it? What would have helped you? What insights do you have? And the answer could be none, because it could be just that difficult of a problem, but it would be, I think, a service to even just hear your initial reactions.
That is a really tough one. Yeah. Gosh, I'm really thankful that I didn't, even with my Southern family, I didn't directly harm any relationships in my life. So I'm very happy about that. I've thought about this quite a bit, and it's not so much that my answer is none, but it kind of is. At least with this particular ideology, funnily enough, I remember having a conversation with somebody about how I could help a family member who is going down the QAnon route, while I was in the midst of all this and I was reaching out to someone else.
Interesting.
How can I help pull this person back from the brink? I don't quite know. I think the concept of our reality is real when we're living it, and trying to present something different that is so such an intense topic is to attempt to alter somebody's reality.
Yeah,
I simply don't know, and I would say that the things that really shifted me out of it included the thing that didn't quite get me at first, but it lingered. And I still think about it, is my friend who came to me and without me even saying anything, we happened to be hanging out. I could just sense there was an unease, and I could sense that there was a defensiveness. If I had been a little further in, a little deeper in all of this, I could have easily interpreted that as that defensiveness as hostility. Mm. Only further validating my point. So I don't think that is necessarily of benefit. I think that the biggest thing is that people just I don't want to say reasonable people. It's relative. Yeah. I think it's important for people who either have defined themselves at one point as liberal or consider themselves to be more left-leaning to be speaking about this stuff, because we don't even have to discuss it in a conservative realm, because it's obvious, it's right there. But it's very muddied on the left, and I really just think that more people need to kind of come forward about this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and just say, and to be able to have more critical conversations, to be able to simply voice concern about what's going on right now, politically and in schools. I think there are going to be, quite a few more sacrificial lambs along the way, unfortunately. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
So some thoughts that had occurred to me, both because I wanted to respond to some people who had reached out.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to know what you would have done in retrospect.
I think, so what I said to some friends was just that time is the big one. I think that people want the world to make sense, and ideologies like this don't. And it's really, it's you can ignore that for a bit, but I don't think you can ignore that forever. And I also think that if I try to shake him out of it in the middle, it's not going to work because the whole construct is set up to debate people, right? So the whole point is to resist people trying to change your mind. But what I think does happen is some random one-off life event will occur to you and your mind will inevitably start to change without other people trying to make it change. And then be there for people when they're starting to come up on the upswing, because I think they'll get there on their own. It sometimes will take a lot of time and sometimes it might not happen, but to know that people are going through it and they have to get there on their own, and then fucking be there when they get to the other side. Yeah.
I think being very clear, whether it's privately or in public, that, transgressions will be forgiven. Yeah. That there's a walk back, and that, and I mean, this is part of the counterproductive, sort of political culture around, making fun of the other side. And when it becomes somebody is the butt of a joke, you're starting to throw shame into the mix. You're getting to a point where there's no reconciliation, there's no return from it. Yeah. And I think there are a lot of things that I kind of laugh at now, but one thing that I'm very careful of is to, I guess, to try to not do to others what I did to myself, which was to allow myself to be somewhat defined by ideas, or to attach my identity to my ideas. So I try to not do that to others.
Yeah. I need to work on not doing that better.
I think more so in a, more so in like a public setting is where I see it being potentially harmful or counterproductive.
I refer to John McWhorter only because he's so goddamn profound on this. And so everyone should read his, The Elect, book, which is, on his Substack. It's amazing. But one thing that he also says is that, if someone is going to try to bludgeon you and say you're a racist for not subscribing to a particular set of views, you can just quietly say, no, I'm not, and change the subject. Showing that doesn't have the force that it used to, I think is much more powerful than people give it credit for. And so you don't need to lock into the argument of the definitions of racism. You can just kind of say, I'm not, and this is a silly thing to say, and change the subject. And these kind of small acts of not being intimidated, I think, can go quite far. Because we just have to remind ourselves that the whole reason I think the word ideology is of value is because there are certain sets of ideas that are set up to be constant debate and never lose. And so the non-participation card, I think, is often underused, and it needs to be emphasized more.
I think your apology earlier, it's appreciated, but to be clear, like, I don't know, had you approached me, if that would have actually led to damage to our relationship. I don't know. You don't know. Yeah. And even had I come on the other side, when people have deeply damaging encounters like that. As you know, Vaden and I have a mutual friend. This was something of a falling out occurring over one of these topics. And even with a changed mind, the sort of the damage that's done beyond the ideas level or the convictions level is messy and awkward. And I can look back and say that I don't wish that you had reached out. Mm-hmm. I don't wish that you hadn't either, but I don't necessarily think that that would have yielded anything positive, and it may have been worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I can't say, it's so personal. Yeah. I can say that if I full circle back, when it comes down to it, if somebody is angry, the clouding of judgment, the ability to throw away long-term value for a short-term win. I think when somebody's expressing a deep level of hurt and anger like that, there's not a very clear way as to how to get through with them mentally. Yeah. So the hands-off approach, I think, is a great idea for somebody who is feeling frustrated by these things and feels driven towards action, and the solution might be action
of a particular form, which is to recognize debate is not going to be useful here. So action consists of simply changing the subject and continuing on your relationship pleasantly in as much as possible. I view that as a kind of restrained action, which can be the right one in a particular circumstance. I don't know. Is that kind of the solemn, hopeful way to end it?
I think so. We ought
Marianne,
to wrap it
that
up.
That was just beautiful and amazing.
Yeah, that was epic.
I'm so glad that you came on, and just, we love you so much. And I look forward to just peeing in public in the ocean and falling again very soon.